health, wellness, fitness, relationships, and everything in between. We're removing the taboo from what really matters in midlife. I'm your host, Michelle Folan, and this is Asking for a Friend. Welcome to the show, everyone. In midlife, when we think about our overall wellness, the topics of menopause, weight gain, bone and joint health, and our skin are all top of mind. But what about our livers? This vital organ often gets forgotten until there's an actual issue. Our guest on the podcast today is a specialist in liver disease and gastroenterology, Dr. Supriya Joshi, wants us to be proactive in optimizing the health of our livers and prevent disease progression. Her focus on metabolic health is very timely and one that I know will be of great interest to our audience. Welcome, Dr. Supriya Joshi.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you for the invitation to share my passion with you today and all of your listeners.
Well, you caught my eye and caught my interest because of your passion around what you do. Before we get started, I would love for you to tell the audience a little bit more about you, where you're from, and also your career path.
First, I'm Canadian for your listeners, and I was born in small town Ontario, Canada. And I'm the eldest of three children. My dad's a retired teacher. My mom's a retired nurse. And so growing up, I have to say they really did instill in us children to take risks, take chances, help people, and education being really important, and to share education. And thinking back to my upbringing, I think that's partly why I've gone on to this trajectory of trying to educate the masses. You know, as I look at it as my public service. I also had amazing family members that were inspiring to me who were doctors, some of them. So I was interested in science, biology, health, went down that route. I did my undergraduate degree at Western University, and I did an undergrad in physiology. And then I got into medical school there. And then I went to the University of Toronto, where I did my internal medicine residency, followed by my gastroenterology fellowship. And then I realized, you know, things I was more interested in, and I wanted a more niche practice. I did another fellowship in liver disease, which is called hepatology. At that point, I had to make a choice. Do I stay in the academic venue and pursue research? And I had been doing both bench research, clinical research. I published in those fields. But I realized I really liked education and clinical care, taking care of patients. We had this opportunity to do electives in the community, and I did a few of them. And I was super lucky to be offered jobs. And this is what kind of made me change my mind from being an academic physician to going into the community, which is not so far from the university center anyway. So I was fortunate to get a position as a gastroenterologist with a specialty in liver disease. And it's one of the largest, busiest urban hospitals in Canada, just outside of Toronto. And I've now shockingly been in practice for 20 years. I'm a mom to three kids. I've got a supportive husband. And as I've gotten older and observed my patient practice as it's changed over time, this has further helped me get to where I am today with education, because I'm realizing we have all these diseases. And when you go into the career path as a doctor, it's so focused on disease management. There really was no education on prevention, nutrition, lifestyle. I think I'm not even sure how much of an emphasis is even in medical school today. So I was forced to self-learn a lot of things because I realized I'm not serving my patients for whom I don't have medications for. You know, I have my GI practice where I do endoscopy. I've got medications to treat inflammatory bowel diseases. And then in terms of liver disease, I came into liver disease when hepatitis C treatment was finally available. So hepatitis C was our focus in preventing liver failure, liver transplant needs, and liver cancer. That was fantastic. We succeeded in treating people, helping them make a difference in their lives and their trajectory of health. Same with autoimmune liver disease and hepatitis B. But then we had this whole area called fatty liver disease, and it wasn't really talked about. It was kind of this annoying condition because, yeah, we have no treatment. Tell people to go lose weight.
Right.
But that to me was just not satisfying because I would realize people don't know how, nor was anyone in medicine making the connection between their diabetes management and their heart disease and their elevated weight and their arthritic issues and inability to mobilize. And yet this liver was largely ignored. And I had no focus there before, you know? And so that's what really got me changing my own education path. I had to self-learn, but how I communicated with my patients and to give them some empowerment.
Well, you bring up a couple things here. First of all, that when you're in medical school and also your residency, some of the training you receive isn't focused on necessarily the prevention piece. And I've heard this from other doctors I've had on the show. But as a liver specialist, you come off as someone who is truly an advocate for overall health. You don't just talk about the liver, because I guess what I'm picking up from you is that poor liver health can be so far-reaching in its whole effect on the body.
You're 100% right. I'm so thrilled that you figured that out, because with the way I now see liver disease, as I said, we've got the stuff I have treatment for. And then we've got the other top liver disease, which are alcohol, the treatment, stop alcohol. Then it comes down to this whole gamut called fatty liver disease, which is now the number one leading cause for liver transplant in North America. And we have no medical therapy for it.
Wow.
That's one alarm bell that I saw in my practice. I had all these patients who had a constellation of their diseases, such as bad diabetes on insulin, bad heart disease, developed kidney disease related to their poor diabetic management. And then their liver enzymes would keep on fluctuating. And then eventually they'd have development of a severe scarring of the liver. We call that liver cirrhosis. And now they're on increased doses of insulin, which is further harming their liver health because it's a growth factor. Their liver starts to fail. And all of a sudden, I'm the doctor taking care of this patient with all these other diseases, but they're in liver failure. And now, according to very standardized scoring systems that we have, they actually meet criteria for a liver transplant. Mm-hmm. So I would take care of my patients, support them, refer them on for liver transplant. But I already knew they weren't going to be a candidate. And that's because they've got bad heart disease. They would never survive the operation. They've got such brittle diabetes, and they've got very poor compliance to kind of optimize that and take their medications. So this poor patient, they're only in their 50s or 60s, and now they're palliative.
Yeah.
And that broke my heart. And I see this pattern over and over and over again. So to answer your question, it is a widespread disease of which the liver tends to be a victim of all the other medical conditions, or you can look at it the other way. The fatty liver came first. And I don't think anyone's looking at it that way. And that's how I decided to take this on, is that before they were a type 2 diabetic needing medications, before they had their first heart attack, they had fatty liver. Either no one looked or no one talked to them about it. And that is the most common thing, because it's everywhere. It's in 2/3 of North Americans that they had an abdominal ultrasound. Fatty liver would be detected.
Oh, that much?
Yeah. But that wasn't the reason they had the ultrasound. Yes.
And that's not something that's typically done unless there is, quote unquote, a problem.
That's exactly it. It was an incidental finding. They had that ultrasound because of abdominal bloating or pain, rule out a gallstone, and the radiologist report will often say evidence of fatty liver. But when I talked to my patients about it, it wasn't always brought up, or it was mentioned, but no one knew what to do with this. Stop drinking alcohol is what they were told. Because I think the connection to metabolic health and insulin resistance is still a major gap in healthcare. And that's why I've taken this on to give education about.
Okay. I'm going to let you just talk about the genesis of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, because I was telling my husband about this when he was home just now, and I told him what we were going to be chatting again. And he's like, that's super interesting. And you know, the first thing he did, he looked at the sugar content on the lemonade that he was drinking. So,
yes, I love that. So he's figured it out. First, let's address the term you brought it up, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This is a really old name given mostly by radiologists and pathologists. So when they would investigate people or assess people with these abnormal liver enzymes, they did imaging like an ultrasound or a CAT scan. And the way that the liver projected or reflected the light, it looked fatty. And then if this area was biopsied, it was fat. That's how it got its name. And the problem is that it's the message out there is that fatty liver disease is caused by people eating fat. And the issue is that that is not the case. And in fact, just this year, that disease has been renamed. It's now being called metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. So it's a whole mouthful. It's called MASLD, M-A-S-L-D. And that's partly to take away the stigma from calling something fat. And in addition, to give it a more correct relationship between metabolic disease, because what we see as fat in the liver is directly related to people's metabolic health. When I see people who I get a radiology report, they've had a biopsy, and or I suspect it's fat in the liver causing the problem, I want them to realize that this is a huge signal to their future metabolic health, and we have to pay attention. And I find this is a condition that's often overlooked, and that's because it seems like every adult over age 50 has it. It's just so prevalent, but not commonly addressed with people, and therefore people are left to their own vices, wondering, well, how do I fix this? I'll stop eating fat. I'll stop eating my eggs and my yogurt because that's filled with fat. But that's the wrong treatment. So I love that you've asked this question, because we can use it as a way to really educate people. Liver fat comes from the liver's natural process to produce fat from excessive sugar consumption or fructose consumption.
Oh.
So when somebody consumes a sugary beverage that contains, let's say, 10 grams of sugar, like a can of Coke does, but also if they have something that's not sweet tasting, like a bagel, which has 80 grams of carbohydrate, when we eat or drink those products and we digest them, they both become glucose. Our cells don't know the difference. So when this glucose is circulating, the glucose is supposed to get into the cell to provide the cell some energy. But it can't just go into the cell on its own. It needs the hormone insulin to open that cell door, and then glucose goes in, a natural process occurs. But when there's too much of this glucose, your cells stop saying or start to say, I'm not going to respond to that insulin anymore. And that's how insulin resistance develops, which basically is the name we provide for people who are pre-diabetic. So now they're insulin resistant, but now where does all that glucose go? Well, now there's a smart process your body created to convert that glucose into fat and store it in your liver, almost like an energy bank, waiting for you to need that energy, waiting for you to undergo starvation, waiting for you to undergo famine. But as we know, in our privileged North American world, for the majority of people, that doesn't happen. So this production or conversion from glucose or fructose into fat and storage in our liver is a survival mechanism that was very much necessary when we were living in a world without excess. When people have fatty liver, or they're told they do have that, what I hope they realize is that they have to cut back on their sugar intake, fructose intake, refined carbohydrates, and processed foods. And eggs are good. Yogurt's good. Healthy fats are good for you. I'm not telling people to go eat bacon and lard. That's not what I'm recommending, but because there's bad fats and good fats. And you want to try to optimize a variety of good whole foods in people's diets to reverse this. And it can be reversed.
You can. Okay, because that was my next question. Can you reverse fatty liver disease?
Absolutely. And it's by lifestyle change. We have no medications to give people to reverse this. Okay. It has to come down with what you're eating and drinking, the quality of what you're eating and drinking. Have a glass of water or sugar-free bubbly water. Don't have the sugary drinks, because it's very deceiving how much can be in there. And the World Health Organization has made a statement on this, that adults should not have more than 6 teaspoons of sugar a day, which is 24 grams. So this is where it comes down to sugar math. We, none of us learned this in school, but 4 grams of sugar is 1 teaspoon. As you pointed out, your husband looking at lemonade, but a glass of lemonade, I'll bet you will have 6 to 8 teaspoons of sugar in it.
Yeah, it does.
You know, so, and so that right there in one drink, you're potentially blowing your sugar budget just with that one drink. So think about how much people are consuming. And the typical North American is having about 20 to 22 teaspoons of sugar a day. When I talk to my patients, most have no idea where they're getting it from.
Well, it's the Starbucks 4-pump venti latte or whatever. It's the things that we don't really think about. You know, we can read labels all day long, but there's the sneaky stuff, those things that are habits of ours every single day that we just don't account for.
100%. And that's why education and awareness is key. And I know when I educate my patients, I encourage them to read labels and slowly wean themselves off those sugary drinks. And soon, if they were to have a drink like that, they would not like it. So your brain chemistry can change super quickly by just weaning off of sugar, then you won't even have that craving of wanting it. And that all is just to help people's not only reverse their liver disease, but also to hopefully prevent extra weight gain. It can prevent high blood pressure or reverse it. It can even reverse early diabetes. A lot of good things can come out of just understanding what you're eating and drinking on a daily basis. So diet's part of it. Good sleep's part of it. Exercise is a big part of it. Talking about muscle mass, everyone needs to be working on improving their muscle mass as they age, not just for survival, but just for being metabolically more healthy.
Perfect. You brought up cirrhosis before, and I know when most people think of cirrhosis, they think of, you know, their Uncle Bob who drank a little too much and had cirrhosis. That's what most people think of cirrhosis. But the way you termed it, it's a broader condition.
So cirrhosis by definition means a severe cross-linked scarring of scar tissue within the liver. And you would typically see that in a liver biopsy, or various non-invasive tests may give this indication. It is not a process or a result that happens quickly. It takes decades to occur in most people. Most people don't have liver cirrhosis. They have either mildly elevated liver enzymes if their doctor checked it, or they may have some degree of fatty liver, that it's fat deposition within the liver cells. But cirrhosis can happen no matter what is injuring the liver on an ongoing basis, whether that's a viral infection, whether it's an autoimmune disease, whether it's a hereditary disease, there's alcohol consumption, and then there's the dietary lifestyle issues I'm trying to educate people about. But only when cirrhosis happens, then there's the risk of having liver failure and increased risk of liver cancer.
Okay. All right. The risk of liver cancer can be there with any of these issues. How about hepatitis? So if you have hepatitis, can you be more predisposed to liver cancer as well?
Yes. And I'm glad you brought it up, because the word hepatitis has a bad name, because I think there's a lot of connotations, whether it be infectious or alcohol. The word hepatitis just comes from Latin roots. Itis is inflammation. Hepa is of the hepatitis of the liver. So it's inflamed liver, and anything can lead to that, even a medication. To answer your question, the most common viral infections that are chronic that need treatment are hepatitis B and hepatitis C. Hepatitis B is probably one of the leading causes of liver cancer in the world, in addition to things we've talked about like alcohol-induced cirrhosis or even the inflammatory fatty liver disease version. Those are what can increase the risk of liver cancer. Rarely do autoimmune diseases do that.
Is there any heredity component with liver disease and liver cancer?
There are, but they're extremely rare and uncommon. So I don't think that would be the focus. And I will say, some people will say, yeah, my parents had fatty liver disease. Is that inherited? And I'll say, no, it's not actually genetic. But what is inherited is what you've learned about your lifestyle and upbringing, how you live your life every day. And that's more a behavioral issue. That's been learned behavior versus true genes at play.
Well, we can say that about diabetes and other issues around metabolic diseases, right?
Yeah.
I want to go back to hepatitis real quick, because you were saying that there's been a lot of advancements in hepatitis, and I really don't know the difference between A, B, and C.
Okay. So hepatitis A is an infection people can get from contaminated food products, mostly shellfish, contaminated water, and it's what's called an acute infection. So you get sick, you can get nausea and vomiting, you could turn yellow, like your eyes or skin could become yellow, but people generally recover from that. That is a preventable infection by getting vaccinated against hepatitis A. Hepatitis B and C, when you acquire them, you rarely get rid of it on your own. So they're the ones that lead to chronic hepatitis. So chronic hepatitis B or chronic hepatitis C, both of them are viral infections, and our body does not do a good job of getting rid of it on their own. And that's where people need help, because the consequence of having those chronic infections is that they are always injuring the liver, and that eventually can lead to scarring, significant scarring, and even liver cirrhosis. And that's where, again, the increased risk of liver cancer can come in, or liver failure. So in terms of treatments, hepatitis B, we still have no cure for. And there's a minority of people with hepatitis B that do qualify for lifelong antiviral therapy. after a certain age, like age 50, then they need ultrasounds of the liver to screen them for liver cancer as well. Anyone who has chronic hepatitis B with an elevated liver enzyme or high viral load, this is something that their doctors would be checking. They're someone who will likely need antiviral therapy. Others don't, but they need monitoring by their primary care physicians. Hepatitis C, there has been major advancements over the last two decades. Right now, we have medications that are all oral, so by mouth, as little as 8 weeks or 12 weeks, depending on which brand you decide to go down, with almost a 99% cure rate and no side effects.
Oh.
There has been a major significant advancement in hepatitis C eradication to the point the WHO, or World Health Organization, made a mandate of eradication of hepatitis C from the planet by 2030. So the United States is on board, Canada is on board. And so this is leading to more public awareness. See your doctor, get screened for hepatitis C. Back in the day when Pamela Anderson was a huge advocate for this because she herself had it, as did some other, I know, big TV stars, this led to the, you know, baby boomers getting screened, people who've had an exposure even 30, 40 years ago of tainted blood. And that could have been from even one exposure to injection drug use or cocaine snorting or a shared needle or a shared from a tattoo that wasn't done professionally. Just at one time, people are at risk of getting hepatitis C if it was contaminated instrumentation. And there's also, you know, blood transfusions before people screen blood. And in Canada, we had a huge scandal back in the 80s where there was tainted blood given to many innocent Canadians.
Oh, that's frightening.
Yeah.
But I am so excited that there are therapies out there that seem relatively easy to take.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great news. I get the liver cancer risk. And for some reason, I wrote down, what about dementia? And I don't remember why I wrote down dementia, but is there a link with dementia and liver disease?
Well, interesting. If it's metabolic disease, absolutely, because it's all the same thing. You know, they're calling dementia, various forms of it, type 3 diabetes, you know, so related to metabolic health or poor metabolic health and insulin resistance, absolutely there's a connection, which is why, again, I'm trying to educate people about all little steps you can do in your lifestyle in your 30s, in your 40s, in your 50s to be preventative so we can all live long and healthier, right? And then we call that health span, live longer, healthier.
Right. Yay. I'm like, yes.
Yes.
Yes, Supriya. I would love for you to give us the straight answer on where your peers are on the subject of alcohol.
Great topic. And this has caused lots of emotional conversations, even in my friend groups. Yeah, so Canada took the lead on this. And they published out a position statement on alcohol safety. And the recommendations are that there is no safe level of alcohol because with regular alcohol consumption, there's increased risks of certain cancers. In fact, alcohol consumption is associated with 13 different cancers, but a few are a little bit higher risk. Brain health, gut health, cardiovascular health, all of that is related to a negative outcome. None is considered healthy. And this is not a popular statement amongst many groups of friends, I'm realizing. Then it comes down to what is considered low risk. Low-risk drinking is under 2 standard drinks a week. 3 to 7 drinks a week, you start to get associations with increased risks of cancer, specifically colorectal and breast. And over 7 drinks a week is when you get the increased risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, and other associated risks that come with that. Back in the day, when people said, oh yeah, you know, 1 to 2 drinks a day is healthy for women and up to 3 a day for men, that is no longer the case.
I knew you were going to say that.
Sorry. But any benefits that were thought, they're realizing from European studies, if you look at data on cirrhosis from alcohol, it is huge in Europe. No one's talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
People think, oh, in France, they go and drink their wine every day, but they're also suffering from cirrhosis.
Yeah, you don't hear that.
You don't hear that. But if you look at the metabolic data, yes, they eat better. If they follow the traditional diet, they do eat better. Not what's going on in the Western world. And the North American diet, unfortunately, is taking hold in Europe and Asia too. You know, gone are the days of that supposed observed effects of good diet.
Right. I do have a question. It's a personal question, but I think other women are going to relate to this. Why is it now in midlife and I'm post-menopause when I have an alcoholic beverage, I feel like I've had three. I just don't feel like I'm metabolizing alcohol the same way as I used to.
That is an amazing question, Michelle, because know that you are not alone. I noticed the same thing. And this is not something that I ever learned in medical school. We had to go and search this out. Like, why is this happening to me? A lot of my girlfriends also notice that. And some men do too. My husband does notice that too as we age. It's interesting. It's not just one thing, but you're not imagining it. And it relates to natural processes that are occurring to our bodies as we are all aging. As we're aging, and you probably know this already, but we all lose our muscle mass. It's estimated that we can lose between the ages of 50 and 70, almost 1% of muscle mass per year. And understanding muscle physiology is that muscle contains more water in it than fat does. And as we age, muscle is replaced by fat. And that's when people who are not trying to preserve their muscle mass, but even if they are, it's hard to really be on top of that issue. So number one, we're losing muscle mass and we're losing our free water. So when you have that drink, it sits in the water. So when you have less water, it's more concentrated.
Right.
So the alcohol, the blood alcohol level for that same drink you may have had 5 years ago can now be higher. So that's issue one. This is simple. The natural process of aging promotes this higher blood alcohol concentration. And for women, as they become perimenopausal, postmenopausal, declining estrogen levels.
Yes.
That also increases visceral fat. And so women are already gaining more fat just as a result of the menopausal, the biological process that are naturally occurring. And then on top of that, we have to look at natural enzymes that our bodies all have to metabolize alcohol. And that's called alcohol dehydrogenase. And as we age, we produce less of this enzyme. So we're not metabolizing it. So again, that alcohol will hang around. So it's no wonder as we age, you feel that drink hits you earlier, faster, and longer. And the other thing to consider is that as we're aging, there's also the increased likelihood you could have another medical problem. And you might need antibiotics. You might need a medication for another medical problem going on. And there could be an interaction with how our liver metabolizes alcohol. It might be slowed down. And that could, in the third way, increase blood alcohol levels. So great question. People out there, you're not imagining it. It's real.
It's something that I have friends tell me all the time. And actually, I was having a chat with a friend this morning, and she said the same thing. So if we could do a study, I think we would have a lot of people that would be like, I'm in that camp.
Totally.
I wanted to ask you, why would someone opt for a liver detox or a cleanse? Are they safe and effective?
They're not. You know, and I just did a post the other day and I realized that a lot of patients take them and I ask about it and it is an utter waste of people's money. There's nothing you can take that periodically that will cleanse your liver or your gut for that matter. It really is about consistency and treating your body well with good health and good nutrition. That is a liver detox. You know, avoiding sugar, alcohol, and refined carbohydrates are really the main crux of that. There's no drink you can take that's magically going to make your liver get healthy. It's a very lucrative industry for people to get into, but it's a waste of people's money. And it can even cause harm. I have seen cases of liver failure from some herb that's been in something that people thought was healthy, and it's not. So it's not worth the risk, and it's definitely not worth people spending their money on that.
That brings up a great point that if you are going to take some kind of an herb or some kind of a detox cleanse, check it out with your doctor first before you do any of those things, because you never know if you're already taking something that there could be some kind of contraindication or bad side effect, you know, if taken together. So
absolutely, because an herb might be fine at a normal concentration, but at a high dose, it becomes potentially interactive, you know, with something else in your body or a medication you're taking. The result can be disastrous.
Absolutely.
And just in fairness to their doctors, they may not even know either. I mean, so little information is known about this stuff.
Right, because they're not studied. It's not like the FDA is out there
checking
out milk thistle.
That's exactly it.
How that does in the body. Metabolic risk has gotten a lot of buzz lately, and particularly, you know, we've got Ozempic out there. We've got people wearing constant glucose monitors. Besides family history, how can we best assess our metabolic risk?
Well, it's a question that no one, I think many people don't think about it. And I hope that they do start thinking about it because earlier intervention is key and people can do this on their own. So one thing is self-realization of weight gain or being objective and taking a tape measure and just measuring your waist circumference. That's measuring the widest part of your abdomen. And that might give some clues. And there's good data on this. Like it's all over the internet. We don't really follow body mass index or BMI. I don't think it's not as indicative of risk as we once thought. And when we look at metabolic disease, what does correlate is the visceral fat. And that's the fat collection, you know, around the waistline. A larger waistline is not good for future health when it comes to cardiovascular risk. And so when I tell people to measure their waist circumference, what we consider, it's not zero risk, but low risk for a man is a waist circumference under 37 inches. Over 40 inches is high risk. And for a woman, low risk is under 31.5 inches and high risk is over 34 and a half inches. When I say it's not zero risk, that's because even a thin person with a not great lifestyle can still be at high risk of metabolic disease. People hiding under thinness can also, you know, be fooling themselves. Being thin is not fit.
Because we all have that one friend that's super thin and does all the bad things.
Right? It's not fair.
Darn them.
But it does catch up with them eventually.
I guess it would.
You don't want that to happen to people, but it does.
Yeah. So what are you seeing in patients using Wegovy and Ozempic? Are you seeing some pretty positive cardiovascular outcome data with Ozempic?
They did. It was beautiful to see. You know, so certainly there's something going on with the GLP-1 receptor in various organs of the body. So yes, it not only provides weight loss, improved diabetic management, but as we just reported just 2 weeks ago, the report came out on improving cardiovascular risk. From a liver doctor, what's still missing is the improvement on liver fibrosis stage. And that's why it's still not indicated for me to prescribe for my patients with fatty liver disease or fibrosis, because it has not yet been shown to improve liver fibrosis in people with fatty liver disease, even though it's associated with all those conditions. I think part of the problem is that the studies just aren't long enough. As I said to you earlier, it does take years for fibrosis to occur. Similarly, it's going to take more than 12 months for us to see improvement. But I love seeing the benefit for my patients from those cardiometabolic factors, and they're always happy with their weight loss. The only thing that I do encourage people to do, though, is to strength train. And that's because with any of these weight loss medications, you will get the desired weight loss, but you're also going to lose muscle mass. Over the age of 30, we all lose 1% of muscle mass per year. And as we age, you're going to be left with being a skinny, frail person who can't get off the floor.
Right.
You don't want to be that.
I know.
All of us, especially perimenopausal women as well, strength training, I'm realizing I'm in that same age group, is super important to our insulin sensitivity, keeping us well for now and for the future. So I want people who are on like Wegovy, Ozempic to realize while that injection a week is going to make them reach their desired goals, that exercise and fitness is still something they have to put effort into.
My friends laugh at me because I tell them, yeah, one of my main goals is that if I should fall, that I can get up off the floor unassisted. They look at me, they think that's so crazy. I said, no, trust me. It's something that we should all strive for.
That's amazing. You've said that when you've had that conversation because it's truth.
It really is.
Total truth.
All right. My next question, is sugar addictive?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, studies show sugar is just as addictive as cocaine. It leads to that surge in dopamine, that reward center in your brain getting lit up and full of joy when you have sugar. And industry makers know this, and there's a certain measurement that you get this signal called the bliss point. That's when you're addicted. And they know they've got you, and they want you to go buy more and more and more of it. They have, you know, the dollars as their objective. But for people, it is absolutely addictive. And you know you're addicted when you want it again. And it made you feel great. You know you have a sugar addiction when you go through those ups and downs, the glucose high, the dopamine high, and then the insulin level goes up to bring that blood sugar down. And now you're exhausted, you're fatigued, you're grumpy. And you're like, you know what? I want to feel good again. I want to feel like I did 2 hours ago. I'm going to go get more cookies. And that's how that cycle keeps happening of crashing and getting hungry again. And I think the result of that is that people end up with poor sleep quality, low energy, and they think that they were so energetic when they had that sugary drink or treat or whatever they were having, and they just want it more and more. So absolutely, sugar is totally addictive.
I had to ask that because I've talked to people that are like, no, it's not. You can back away from it. And I'm like, I think that's harder for some people than others. So
absolutely.
I wanted to ask you that. You posted something on Instagram recently, and I love this recommendation, about eating your veggies first before you eat what else is on your plate. Is there any other kind of diet recommendations that you have? Like, do you like the Mediterranean diet? What's your thing?
I think whatever healthy diet people can adhere to is the right diet. I want people to realize what they're used to having. The North American diet, the quantity, the poor quality is not in their health interest. And so there's many ways to improve this. So I think having a name of a diet just makes it easier because they can go look it up and see, okay, this is what I want to adhere to. But I'm glad you like that idea about having your vegetables first, because in terms of being a gastroenterologist and just simple gastric physiology and gastric emptying and the satiety centers and make your brain realize you're full, having fiber first does that. It achieves all of that. It takes time for you to chew it, which slows down eating. And once you've had that vegetable, it slows down absorption. It fills your stomach more. So you're already feeling full a little bit by having a big salad first and getting lots of good nutrition in there. And then so then I recommend vegetables first, followed by your protein, which is also really important because many people don't get enough protein in their diets, which pay a price later. Then your healthy fats. And then if you really want to have your carbohydrate, have it at the very end. But definitely don't have it at the beginning because that will spike your blood sugar, make you feel tired, and you're not going to feel full. And that's going to make somebody want to overeat and have more and more platefuls of food. So the plateful of pasta is not the best meal to have for someone when you're trying to change your direction and become more metabolically healthy. So in terms of diet, I said whatever diet someone can stick to is great. And I try to educate people that the North American diet, how much carbohydrate it has, and what we typically call a low carbohydrate diet, I say a target goal is 100 grams a day or under that. That's actually what should be called a normal diet.
Okay.
And making people realize what the world is at and what's good for their health.
And then exercise, same thing. Do exercise that you're going to do and stick with. It doesn't have to be anything super fancy, right?
Not at all. And that's the thing. There's just your basic activity. And people need to understand that's different from exercise. So there's people thinking either 10,000 steps a day or 6,000 steps a day. That's still a great target to have because you could easily sit in front of a computer all day long, depending on what some people's occupations are. You know, and that is an occupational hazard. Sitting all day at your desk is just as bad as smoking for cardiovascular risk. And so getting people to realize that, to get up, get a desk that goes up and down even, can be hugely helpful to their health. And so I want people to realize that activity is different from exercise, and that exercise is intentionally getting your heart rate up. And you should try to strive for at least 150 minutes a week. And even with that, you know, you don't have to run a marathon because there's people who are afraid of running. They're afraid of sweating. They don't want to do all that. You don't have to do that. And there's strength training is one part of it, which will also get your heart rate up. But in terms of cardiovascular exercise, there's something called zone 2 training. That's just getting your heart rate up to 80% of your maximum. So it's conversational pace. And you can do that with rucksacking, with a weighted backpack on and go for a walk. You can go for a jog. You can go for a bike ride. And I encourage people to, you know, get a way to measure it. It doesn't have to be an Apple Watch, but something like that that can measure their heart rate. If they don't know what their maximum heart rate is, a surrogate for that is taking 220 minus your age. And then 80% of that should be your target heart rate when you want to do zone 2 training.
I'm writing that down because I'll put that in the show notes.
Oh, great.
Because I have been doing the zone 2 because I listened to some other podcasts and I thought, oh, okay, that's doable. I want people to understand that's actually not an uncomfortable heart rate.
That's exactly it. It's doable, right?
It is.
And yet there's a lot of benefit to that. As I'm sure if you've read about it, you get, you know, improvement in your mitochondrial health, which is a key to longevity and cardiovascular health. But as a side effect, according to the things I've read and what I've experienced, you get a bit more fat loss as well because you're in the aerobic zone.
And we all like that.
Yeah, we all like that.
especially in midlife.
Yes.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So what are those little hidden pieces of information for exercise that a lot of people don't realize?
Speaking of midlife women too, and you're giving us some incredible advice, is there any other tips that you would give a woman who is just wanting to start to make healthier changes? Because I think we need to not assume that everybody's on the same path. I mean, there's some people that just need that extra encouragement. What would you say to those people?
I would first want them to realize they're not alone. Talk about it. Talk about it with a friend, because having a buddy to join you on this journey makes it a lot easier and more comforting, I find. Get two people to like look up stuff and then share it with each other and start a project together. So I think not doing things alone is important, but some people can do it on their own as well. So not to discount that, but just to get started, stop saying do it tomorrow. Just today, you know what? Tonight, I'm just not going to eat that, or I'm not going to buy that when I'm at the store, or I'm not going to have that glass of wine with my dinner tonight. I'm going to make that change, or I'm going to go for my walk after dinner and just get those running shoes on and just get started. Starting is the hardest obstacle, is the first obstacle, the biggest obstacle. And once day one is done and they realize they've done it, day two is so much easier. Lots of studies show that.
I agree. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this question, and I may know the answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I was watching, it was a video, a guy with a mic and a camera. They were at a cardiovascular conference and they were asking all these cardiologists, what's the one thing you would never do as a cardiologist? And I would say probably 90% of them said, I wouldn't smoke. So if I went to a hepatology conference and I walked around with a mic and a camera and I came up to you, say, Dr. Supriya Joshi, what's something as a hepatologist, what would you never do? What would that be?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. There's so much, so much I wouldn't do.
Oh, I didn't give you time to think about it.
Yeah, but I would say there's not one thing I wouldn't do. I won't smoke. I'm not going to do that. But I wouldn't drink alcohol every day. I wouldn't have sugary cereal ever. I wouldn't have regular cans of Coke every day. Like, I wouldn't do that every day. And I think the everyday part's a good way to look at it, because we still have our lives to live. Life is a journey. And I love that comment, one of your other guests you had, that it's direction, not perfection.
Yeah.
I love that. And I've even borrowed it, because I think it is such a great, safe message, you know, that it's okay to stray here and there, depending on what your situation is. But as long as you're going forward and making steady improvements, I think that's the huge win. I don't think we need to be so absolute. That confinement, people don't do well in confinement.
I used to work with this guy named Dwayne, and he would say, it's not the exceptions that get you, it's the habits. It's maybe not about totally eliminating any one thing out of your life, because that can cause deprivation, or feelings of deprivation at least. I appreciate that advice. It's awesome. And then My last question for you, what's one of your own very important pillars of self-care?
I think it comes down to realizing I don't need to feel guilty for taking time for myself. And I think a lot of women have inherent guilt. It took me a while to figure that out when I would see it in my patients and I talk to them about it. You know, they could be working women, they've got kids, but they're still doing everything. And I get that. I'm also a wife, a mom, I'm a daughter, and I'm trying to do everything. And it's hard. It's not easy. And I remember seeing a meme, no wonder women are burning out, because we are doing everything. I think one thing that women definitely need to get better at is taking time for themselves. This would be a lot of time, even 45 minutes, 60 minutes. You know, since the pandemic, you know, I started working out at home. I will go to the gym. My husband, my kids fully support it. They get it. They give me my time. And when I'm getting cranky, they'll say, do you need to go work out, Mom? I'm going to go on their case about something. So they realize I'm a way happier person to be around after I come back from exercise.
I can't imagine you being too cranky, but maybe you can.
Oh, it happens. Yeah, I can. Guarantee you.
Oh.
So I think self-care, I think take time for that.
That's such a wonderful way to finish this off, because that's also a big thing that I try to tell people all the time. You got to put yourself first. You know that old saying, and it can get a little trite, but you can't pour from an empty cup. Thank you for sharing.
But that's exactly it, you know?
Yep.
you're all burnt out. You're not going to be there to support the masses around you that need your support.
Yes. And they still need you even as they get older. That's a whole nother topic for another show. Dr. Supriya Joshi, how can people find you?
Well, you brought up my Instagram. That's probably the best way. I am at LiverHealthMD. I started it literally about 6 months ago just to kind of empower people. I just call it my public service because when I see patients and they go, I wish someone told me this 20 years ago, it's that conversation that triggered me to do something. And I didn't know what else to do. I've gone to my hospital to make more public education available. That wasn't the right forum. I've gone to public health in my community. They were so burdened by COVID. And now they're starting to get things up. I thought this is an easy way. I could just post little things to encourage people that they're going in the right direction. And by the feedback, I hope it's helping people. I love it that it's far reaching around the world. It's such a cool way to interact with people.
I encourage everybody to check out Dr. Joshi's Instagram because she has some great tips there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. This was so informative and I hope we get to connect again.
I hope so. This was super fun.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Follow Asking for a Friend on social media outlets and provide a review and share this show wherever you get your podcasts. Reviews and sharing help us grow.